everyone, welcome back to All Time Chatter Podcast. My name is Sudeshna Saha and welcome to this week's new episode. Today I have a very special guest with me in here. His name is Brendan Callahan and he is a Canada-based mental health therapist and nutritionist. I hope you will love this episode because I was always eager to know how the daily life of a therapist actually is, what goes inside counseling and everything. So, yes, let's move forward into this beautiful episode.
Hi, how are you today?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing very well, thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Can you introduce yourself in here?
Sure. So, my name is Brendan Callahan. I'm a psychotherapist and nutritionist working in Newmarket, Ontario. Would you like any background information or
yes,
you think
yes,
that's
yes. Also share your background and
okay. So I'm from Stouffville, Ontario, which is a little bit north of Toronto, Ontario, and I grew up in this area. I went to Peterborough to do my psych degree at Trent University and then moved to Vancouver to do my master's after that. I then moved back home to do my practicum for my master's degree back at Trent, which was nice. And now I'm a psychotherapist working out of a company called Newmarket Therapy Center, downtown Newmarket. And it's been really fun and really rewarding ever since.
Mm-hmm. So like, was doing psychology your first choice as a major?
It was. I identified the field of psychology as a main interest when I was pretty young. I wanted to be a therapist from, I want to say maybe 14. That all kind of came from an affinity from those deep talks you would have with your friends as a kid and as a teen, and trying to help people navigate social situations or familial situations or just any kind of interesting or difficult thoughts. And I've really always had a strong affinity for that kind of thing. So the fact that you can do that professionally for your whole life, it was always really cool to me. So I've long been interested in this career.
It's actually really cool because you get to talk to so many people with different lifestyles as your job every single day, which is like really cool.
Thank you. Yeah, it's amazing. It's an honor to have people who start off as complete strangers, you know, come walk in, sit down, and you know, share all that they share with me. I really have a lot of respect for all of my clients for that. And it's always surprising how immediately the majority of people will open up. Like, so I'm still working in person, even with COVID and all of that. And like, you can't even see half of my face. You know, you just come in, sit down, you've never been in there, and you share all that you share. And it takes a lot of courage, and they all have my respect for it.
Yes, definitely. So Brendan, first I'll start with some icebreaker questions so that we can get a little comfortable, and then I'll ask you all other questions.
Okay, sounds good.
Okay, so which place do you want to travel to now?
Place do I want to travel to? Well, I've got a flight booked for Prince Edward Island in a couple weeks. I've got a lot of family out there that I haven't seen in a long time. So I'm looking forward to that. And that's a beautiful place too. It's a nice little island.
Cool. So what superpower would you choose?
Well, I think mind reading would be would make my job a lot easier. But I think the ability to kind of manipulate time, like to pause things around you, to have a moment to think longer, or to move out of different situations, that'd be a fun one.
What is your biggest goal in your life?
My biggest goal in my life, that's a big question. I think having the largest net positive impact as possible. So, you know, trying to help as many people as you can, or doing your best environmentally, like with, you know, responsible consumption and actually recycling and all those simple things we can do. Just trying to have the biggest net positive. So I think that would be it.
Yes. So the first question which I have for you is, why is nutrition so important to you?
Why is nutrition important to me? As well, I guess, I mean, nutrition is really a fundamental aspect of existence, I think. So the way that the nutrients that we consume play a role in our cognitive functioning and physical functioning is, I mean, you know, there's that old saying, you are what you eat, and that really is true. So if you're consuming high quality nutrients and you're getting yourself the amount of energy that you need to move around throughout the day and to think well and to be active, then that's really a simple, strong formula to a healthy life.
There were a lot of listeners' questions, and I also wanted to know this personally. What is your opinion on diet culture?
Well, I think when it comes to diets in general, like, diet is just a word to describe what you regularly do or don't consume. When it comes to maybe fad diets or crash diets, I know people can get a little bit obsessive with that kind of thing. I think the best approach, so when I work with clients on nutrition, I treat each client as if they're a N equals one experiment. So, you know, things that work for person A might not work for person B. The best diet is a diet that you can enjoy and sustain over time. But if it's getting into things like, some people are really strict on really low fat diets or low carb diets, or I've seen, you know, really obsessions over meal frequency even. So some people think I have to eat a little bit of protein every 2 hours. Some people think I have to not eat anything almost all the time. And then maybe there's a 4 to 6 hour window where I do eat. And all of those different things can work to a certain degree to different people if there is moderation and the caloric and micronutrient ratios are controlled for. But seeing one thing that might work for somebody and then assuming, you know, they got good results on that and that'll work for me and I need to do exactly what they do, I don't believe to be a healthy mindset.
So what your ideal diet would look like?
My ideal, so I think an ideal diet, I guess, again, for everybody's got to just do what works for them. My personal diet, I tend to eat, I make sure I get enough protein for myself. I loosely track my calories to make sure I'm getting around the amount of energy that I need. And I make sure that I'm getting healthy fats in every day, and I do try and tone down simple or refined carbohydrates.
There was another question which someone asked, that there's a common misconception that non-vegetarians are extremely healthy, whereas vegetarians are not healthy. What is your opinion about that?
I think whether or not somebody's eating meat isn't I mean, you can be healthy as a vegetarian and you can be healthy eating almost all meat. Like, it will come down to macronutrient and micronutrient ratio. So if you have enough, if you're getting enough proteins, there are plant sources of protein that are completely fine. All meats will have whole protein sources as well. And if you're getting in, I mean, there's plant sources of healthy fats as well as animal sources. So for example, omega-3s, like my number one recommendation to anyone is try and get at least 3 grams of omega-3s in your diet a day. So in animals, that can come from fatty fish. In plants, there's things like flax seeds, walnuts, you know, olive oil, those kinds of things. So there's options for everybody to be healthy.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So now I move on to my favorite questions relating to psych, is that, did you ever had any client with a similar experience or circumstance to your own?
I have. So I guess growing up, I had a few issues. I had a pretty hard time with, starting to consume alcohol and other drugs a lot earlier than would be recommended for anybody. And then I maintained that throughout high school, throughout university. In university, I started getting into harder drugs. So, I kind of had developed this mentality of if there's a possibility that something will be fun, I'm going to do it. And one thing that looked like fun was those party drugs. So MDMA, cocaine, all that stuff. And I think, it's that hedonistic impulsivity, that's the real ethos of toxic party culture, especially in youth. And that quickly slipped into dependence. So I was using those kind of drugs to have the energy to work out, try and focus and all that. And that really messed up my hormones and cognitive functioning, because the reward center in the brain, which is the mesolimbic dopamine system, actually works on the same hormones that those drugs stimulate, mostly dopamine, which allows us to look forward to things and to be happy or excited. And mine was pretty fried. And also, really importantly, for a university student, that same system is highly involved in associative learning. I had a really hard time learning anything and feeling happy, and that was really rough. So I do have quite a few young clients. So I work with a lot of people who are in the age range of, say, 15 through 25, and a lot of, that culture does exist to this day in that age range. I'm only 1 year above that age range anyway, but which also helps working with people around that age. But helping them to figure out, like, we'll reflect on what kind of weeks they've had, and they'll be telling me about parties they went to and times that they were able to stand up and, say no to those kinds of substances, and other times where other people are having more issues with them. That really helps with, that experience that I had really helps with one of the three pillars of actually my theoretical orientation. It's called empathic understanding. So the whole goal with that third almost of therapy is trying to put yourself as the therapist in the client's shoes. So that relatability has been an asset overall.
Wow. Being a therapist, you can actually really write a book about your life story. It would be cool.
Thank you so much. That's a very kind recommendation. I appreciate that.
So as you at those times, and how today's youth is also so attracted to these culture, how would you advise them to stay away from these things?
So with drugs, honestly, just straight up, you don't need them. I reflect on this sentiment a lot. If the activity, the situation you're in requires substances to be fun, then that thing or situation is not inherently enjoyable. So, you can do something else. You can find people who are more enjoyable to be around for you. You can find activities within the party that could be more fun. If And a really, really, really common thing for people to do is to use alcohol or other drugs as a sort of social lubricant. I don't like that. I'm not gonna criticize people for drinking casually and responsibly. That's completely okay. But if you are finding yourself using substances as a social lubricant or to kind of relax, then and you can catch yourself in those moments, I would highly recommend just seeing somebody for at least a little bit. So reaching out to a therapist in your area. Social anxiety is really common, and there are hours worth of interventions that can be explored with your therapist that can help you overcome that to get to the point where you can confidently walk into a party being your authentic self and engage in a way that's more healthy and enjoyable to you overall.
So, what therapy do you practice personally?
So I practice person-centered psychotherapy or client-centered psychotherapy, which is a psychodynamic approach. It entails three core conditions. The first, I mentioned a little bit earlier, that empathic understanding. So that's taking the frame of reference of your client to really try and understand what they're saying to you from the place they're saying it. The second is authenticity or congruence. And what that means is I need to be authentically myself, as well as, and that entails essentially just honesty. Like, I don't lie at all to my clients in any capacity. So you don't pretend you're feeling some way if you're feeling or thinking some other way. You don't use interventions you don't honestly think are going to be helpful. So I won't just kind of like give like a handout just for the sake of handing the client something to take home so they feel like they've done something. You really do need to be honest in the way you present yourself and the way that you approach therapy. And the third is unconditional positive regard, which means no matter what kind of things any client shares with me, any thoughts or feelings or behaviors from the past or the present or plans for the future, I have to accept and remember that this person, it has unknowable potential for positivity and growth. And nothing can take that away from them. And woven into that is an inherent stance of being non-judgmental. That's not my place at all. It's especially not going to be helpful in therapy. People need to be heard. So it's trying to understand honestly the client, trying to meet them where they're at, trying to see what it is that they're experiencing, expanding on that to help them kind of weed out. What are the things that they're doing that are authentic to them? What are the things they're doing that are not? So the word we use for that is incongruent. Once you pull out those incongruences, the client can exist as a full, as a clinical term, we say a fully functioning person, or in a state of self-actualization where you're authentically yourself. You're using your autonomy. You're recognizing your competence, and you're engaging with others to facilitate relatedness, which are the three psychological needs, if anybody was wondering what those are. But that, so it's sitting, talking, exploring. I'll offer in interventions from other therapeutic approaches. So recently I've been using a lot of cognitive behavioral therapy for clients who like to think. So that, as the name entails, works on shifting patterns of thinking and behaving. Existential therapy is really helpful for creating or finding meaning in tough areas of life. Solution-focused therapy is helpful for people who have, like, sometimes people come in for one or two sessions. They just got an acute issue that they really need to action plan for, and they need the solution fast. So we'll do that. And then I'm also a nutritionist, and that comes into play with things like hormonal functioning, energy, nutrition, and mental health are pretty tightly correlated. So I like to check in with nutritional and physical health strategies, as well as kind of that psychosocial sphere of or perspective on wellness.
This is also like my favorite question, is that what is the best part of your job and what is the toughest part about your job?
The best part of my job. Wow, there are a lot of good parts. I love it when, like, I get really fired up when people kind of realize they can do more than they think they could. That's so amazing to me. So, and I mentioned earlier anxiety, social anxiety, that's so common, and a lot of the time that comes out of self-doubt. It can be, it's fear, self-preservation. There are different ways that people develop anxiety, but the way you clinically treat anxiety isn't actually to make the anxiety go away. That's not the focus. The focus is helping the client understand that they're actually greater than the thing they're scared of. And then that later on will allow that anxiety to kind of go away. But that realization, when you observe a client coming to that realization of, you know what, I think I've been selling myself short here, and I think I can actually do a little bit more than I thought I could, and I'm gonna step into this. I'm gonna, there's something I'm scared of doing, and I'm gonna willingly confront that on my own. That switch that happens in their psyche and in their personality, and it plays a role in even things like the way they stand, like posture is moderated by serotonin, and serotonin's the hormone that allows you to know how cool you are, essentially. It gives you a sense of your self-efficacy. And when you see that growing, that really is amazing. I think that's my favorite part. That's a really long answer to that really simple
No,
question.
so there's another thing is that what happens when you're having a terrible day as a counselor? Like sometimes maybe you can have bad days. So what do you do in those days? How do you deal with your clients?
So, are you asking if I'm on a personal level having a hard day and I have to go into work, or if
Yes.
maybe work's not going so well? Okay, so if I'm having a hard day,
Personal level.
what I need to do is I need to realize when I'm in, and this actually isn't that hard, thankfully. But when I'm in the room with the client, all that's on my mind is that client. Like, I'm focusing on those three core conditions of putting myself in their shoes, really understanding them, really accepting them, and taking responsibility to hold that. I don't really like the term safe space, because therapy can be scary. Like, people are talking about hard things, but it's a therapeutic frame wherein it's okay to say whatever you want, and I maintain that, and that's my focus. My focus is on my responsibility of responsible caring. It's an ethical duty. I can't be, worrying about whatever's on my mind at the moment. I can accept that any kind of thoughts or feelings that might come up in session that remind me of my personal issues, I can recognize those as uncomfortable, allow them to float on by, and get back into what I'm doing there. So that's mostly what I would do. But I think a more proactive approach to that is, if there's something bothering me and I'm on my way to work, I like to I'll treat myself like a client, essentially, and I'll do whatever activity or thought exercise, or I'll try and engage in whatever kind of conversation, if it's a relational thing, that I would recommend to a client to do before going to work, so maybe I can solve it so it's not that hard to carry throughout the rest of the day.
I feel like as the way you said that you will set your boundaries and at that point your client matters to you. I guess like it's like are you guys like taught as therapists that you like don't you ever mix up your feelings with those clients? It's every time you're so passionate about your job that you never mix up your feelings and
So that's a really good question, and it is something that we are taught. So there's cognitive empathy, and there's just kind of your standard empathy or even sympathy. I'll use cognitive empathy and sympathy because it's a more drastic comparison. I think it's a bit more easy to understand. But sympathy is understanding someone's issues and then feeling for them physically. So, I mean, we have a whole brain region. It's kind of like this sideways mohawk in your brain that houses things called mirror neurons that they try to map on other people's nervous systems to us to understand. So that's kind of like in an important conversation, you might notice you or the people around you adopting the same body language. That's a physical observable feature of what those things do and those mirror neurons do in your mind. But they're actively trying to help you feel how other people are feeling so that you can better connect with them and you can understand them. But that's not such a great tool if you're, or it's not such a great feature as a human if you're, say, working with extreme unjust trauma, for example. You don't want to embody those feelings. That can actually help not just therapists, a lot of people in caring professions can develop a diagnosis, you would say, of what's called vicarious trauma. So you actually, it's kind of like you have PTSD without personally experiencing that trauma. Cognitive empathy, the thing that helps me with that is understanding everyone has their own circle of control and responsibility. So in that circle is your own thoughts, feelings, and behaviors. And those are the only things that you can actually control to a certain degree. They're certainly the only things that you are responsible for. So, you know, if I can give a client everything that I possibly can think of, and if it's not working, as long as I know that I've done absolutely everything and I'm being as ethical as I can, then I don't have anything to feel bad about. Also realizing, you know, while you're holding that space with them, you're trying to understand them, but they're not you and you're not them. Like, you're connecting together in that space, but does that answer that question? I feel like I kind of went on a little bit of a tangent.
No, I was literally said that you have your own boundaries set. I was literally wondering, are you guys actually taught something like this or not?
Yeah, so that would be all the education on vicarious trauma and recognizing you don't take your work home with you. You don't want to do that. You have that hour with your client or 50 minutes. You have the time before and after for your preparation notes and your notes afterwards. Not all therapists do it like that. Some people do all their notes in one day, but I like to do it all together just so it's all fresh. And then when that's out, you know, that stays where it stays until the next time you see that client, and then you step back into that sort of world with them. But it's important to not carry any of that home with you.
Wow, I'm learning so much from this.
I'm very glad.
Before moving to my last question, there was also another person who asked that I'm extremely happy and satisfied and I don't have that much problem as other people. Should I be the person who go to therapy sometimes?
That's such a great question, and that's kind of funny because last week I had almost the same conversation with a client. So I'll see maybe, I don't know, like somewhere between 18 to 25 clients a week, and maybe 3 or 4 of them have diagnosed mental experiences that you would find in the DSM-5. So that's the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual. The rest are mostly, everybody has something to work on. Everyone has something to optimize. And I have a lot of clients, actually have really interestingly, just a coincidence, I have 2 brand new clients who opened with saying they feel really good and they're happy with themselves and they want to keep it going and they want to optimize their lives. And that's an excellent goal for therapy. It's, you know, I'm here and I know I'm good where I am, but I also know that I can get better. And there might be some things that I'm overlooking in my life or in me. And I can use myself as an example. So when I was in school, one of the things that we did was we each experienced the variety of modalities of psychotherapy. So you got to sit in that client seat and see what it is that you like and what you don't like, and that can help inform your practice. It also helps you understand what it's like to be a client a little bit better. And I remember thinking, man, this is the best I've felt in years. Like I'd been, I guess, probably about a year and a half sober at that point. You know, I was feeling really happy and healthy and active, and you know, nutrition was all good and all of that, and socially I didn't have any concerns. And so I was thinking, I wonder what I'm gonna, like, what am I gonna get here? And then you go in and there's like 30 different things that you're like, oh wow, I didn't even realize I was doing that, or I didn't realize that was a form of self-sabotage, or maybe I could be nicer to myself. That was a big one for me. I've always been pretty hard on myself, and I had a few automatic negative self-talk pieces that developed as a way to motivate myself, like to work harder or to put more effort into things, but they weren't doing a great job for my mental health. So a few just shifts in the way you word how you speak to yourself, or the way that you look at yourself, even if you think that you're an amazing job, which you can be, therapy can be really helpful for that too. And it can also help keep you up there and help, you know, maybe something goes off and you step into a really difficult circumstance, you can have that space to think out loud and to have an alternative perspective and to work towards a simple, reasonable, or not always so simple, but certainly reasonable and doable way to, or approach to navigate through whatever that unforeseen circumstance might be.
Mm-hmm. Yes, this question was also in my mind. That is why I thought it to incorporate, because so many people think that they're extremely happy and they always want to ask the therapist this particular
question. Right.
There's also one thing you particularly heard about, toxic positivity. What's your opinion about that?
I guess that would depend on the specific individual's application of it. So maybe what would your, in the context of this question, what approach or what amount of positivity would you be interested in kind of critiquing?
Suppose like there was also some question related to that toxic positivity, like suppose if someone lost a particular person and then they are crying, they're emotionally drained, but then there is some person who will always come and show up and tell you to stay positive even in that terrible situation. So what would your outlook be on that term?
Okay, so with that, you know, with those two hypothetical people, what I would think is the person who's coming up and saying stay positive, I understand that that approach would, I mean, the goal is to help that person be positive, to help that person feel better. That's not always what people need, and it's really hard to figure out what people need. So I think what I would say to that person is sometimes just holding the space for somebody to experience a tough emotion is the best thing you can do. You know, sometimes you can sitting and holding space for someone to cry or for someone to vent without then giving them your advice can be incredibly powerful, because it validates, right? There, you can share empathic reflections is what they're called. So pay attention to what they're saying, right? Actually accept that what they're saying is real. It's real at least to them, even if you don't agree with them. It's real to them. Reflect back a couple of the things that you hear them saying. So they're upset because maybe they've lost someone and that person meant something to them. And you can reflect back those summarized points of, you know, you're really close with this person and they've left suddenly and that's hard. Something like that is, that's it. You don't need to go too far beyond that. And I think as I'm thinking about this a little bit more, the toxic aspect of toxic positivity. Like, trying to force someone into being positive isn't going to help. You can't force people into things. There's an experience that humans have, or a reaction humans called. It's called reactance. And reactance is engaged when we feel our autonomy is being infringed upon. So even if you're trying to force me into doing something that might ultimately be good for me, my reactance might be to push against that. Say, you know, how dare you step into my feelings and tell me how to feel? And that might make things worse. So I think trying to force people to feel anyway is not going to be that great. But giving them the space to speak in their mind and to vent frustrations or to cry can be really powerful. All you need is a little bit of a focused attention, a little patience, and, you know, if it's someone important to you, then that can come, hopefully, relatively easily to you through love.
Sometimes actually crying also helps a lot, because whenever I feel bad, I always cry, and after a few hours, I'm all good and all okay.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, your body needs to process things sometimes. You know, and when you're crying, there's a hormone called cortisol that actually exits your body through tears. And cortisol is a stress hormone. It doesn't feel good to hold that in physically. And allowing that out, you're allowing yourself to essentially validate your own emotions by experiencing that. So, you know, you feel sad inside, and then you see that you're sad through the behavior of crying, and that's okay. And when you identify the emotions that you have, you can then check in with what those emotions mean and how you might want to move forward. So if you're sad because you've lost something, you know, that makes sense. You know, that's real. You know, sadness comes up when we're missing out on something, or maybe we're disappointed, or you know, we lost an opportunity to do something, or we had something good and that's gone now, and it's an indicator of some sort of shift. So allowing yourself to experience emotions is really important.
Yes. So my last question to you is that, as you already said that you set your boundaries and all, but I also wanted to ask you that, has there been any client who has influenced you personally, like someone just shared an experience with you and it really hit you hard?
Yeah, there have been quite a few. I think most of my clients, I mean, I learn all the time, you know. I don't have immediate answers for everything with clients. Sometimes they ask me questions, right? And of course, they're the expert on themselves. So if anyone's going to know something about them, it's them. So it's my job to help them figure that out. But a lot of the times that process entails me learning too, like a lot. So clients share knowledge about or different perspectives on the world, knowledge about their careers. I feel like I might be straying a little bit off. Could you repeat the question? I don't want to go on too many tangents. I want to be a little bit more specific if I can.
Yes, you can describe the experience of any client who has struck, like, emotionally struck you with their experience. Like, some experience of that particular client has struck you.
Okay. So I can't legally go into extreme detail of any of the content revealed in my sessions or personal information of all of that, or all of that, of course. But there have been some clients who have experienced mistreatment just chronically throughout life by what seems like the majority of the people they interact with. And, you know, these clients, there is this weird thing where so many of them are so sweet, like they're so kind, and the fact that they've continually just been pushing through this injustice, and of course it takes its toll, but the fact that they're still around, right, like they're making things work, and they're getting themselves help, and they're sharing things that could be hard to share, or are extremely hard to share. and they're still going, and then they start to grow. Like that experience or that true embodiment of what I understand resilience to be, that hits hard. Like that's, it's heavy in the moment. Those are harder sessions, but it's also incredibly encouraging knowing that, you know, that's a human, I'm a human, all humans, like we can all get through so much more than you would think we could get through. And it blows my mind. So that those kinds of experiences have been really impactful for me. It's like, you know, things could be way worse, and they have been way worse, and maybe they'll be worse in the future, but each time you can find a way to get through it. And there's so many ways to get through a given thing. And I've really, that's really been magnified in my mind from a lot of my especially resilient clients.
Yes. So, Brendan, do you have any last advice or any last words that you want to give?
I think last advice.
Yes, anyone who wants to therapist as you.
Oh, anyone who wants to become a future therapist. Well, that's, I think if you want to become a future therapist, definitely go to therapy, see what it's like. See if it's what you would expect. Maybe watch different therapists on the internet. There's the, like my favorite, or the inventor of client-centered psychotherapy. His name is Carl Rogers. You can see him working with people online, real recorded sessions. Just look at what it looks like and you know, think about how you might behave in that situation. Of course, as you become educated, you're going to completely shift a lot of how you think would be the right way to answer certain questions. But try and get involved in some way. Work as a volunteer, as a telephone operator, like a crisis line, and see what it's like to hold that space for people. You know, it's, or just a peer support line, maybe. If you're in university and you have a mentorship type situation or organization going on in your school where upper year students can provide support for lower year student, like anything where you can engage in some kind of one-on-one helping somebody, even tutoring. I was a tutor at Trent for a while, and some of those experiences helping people figure out ways to understand concepts in a way that works to them, you know, even with, I did a lot of stats tutoring, and there's a whole bunch of different ways you can actually come to an understanding of why you would use a certain formula. And that, any kind of engagement, any engagement in helping an individual, just get into that and see what you can do there, and go to therapy.
I literally love this. You said that once you personally experience it by yourself, then only you can know actual reality of how it is.
Right. It's very important to experience things for yourself. And I'm in the media as well. Therapy is depicted in TV shows all the time, and sometimes it's decent and I'm surprised, but almost always I'm like, you would never say that. You know, that's unethical, or this is illegal, or this, why would you bring, you know what I mean? Like, therapy isn't very accurately depicted in the media very often. So if you're wanting to become a therapist based on what you've seen on TV, I would recommend a more realistic experience.
Mm-hmm. So tell people where they can follow you.
Sure. I think the most useful place people can follow, I mean, I have all my personal accounts and all that, but I have an Instagram page called BDLC Cognition and Wellness. And that's actually where I hold a good amount of the real interventions or real activities that I use with my clients in my clinical practice. So, you know, I've done my best to translate them to a format where you can read through them. The captions expand on some things that I might actually say with a client in a real individual session of psychotherapy. And so, you know, you might be able to scroll through those, see if anything resonates with you, is potentially helpful. And if anything does, I'd recommend bringing it to your therapist and saying, like, you know, can we use this tool, or how can we expand on this tool, or can you explain this part of this thing? Because maybe I personally have left out some information that you might want. So you can go to a different professional, or you can just DM me. Honestly, I take no issue in taking the time to explain things. That's where I would recommend BDLC Cognition and Wellness on Instagram.
Yes, I will be linking all of those. So a big thanks to Brendan for giving your time and being in here, because I love doing this with you.
Thank you. No, it was, thank you for inviting me and reaching out, and you know, your questions were excellently formulated. I really do think that you organized this in a way that would be hopefully helpful and interesting to listen to for people interested in nutrition and therapy. And I really appreciate this, and I really appreciated, again, meeting you in this virtual audio format. It's been a really nice way to start my morning out here.
Yes, because the first time when I heard you in Humans First, I was like, this was the best conversation like I ever heard of that podcast. Because wow. I also like texted you earlier that I love that alcoholism part which you described, and I could connect to you. So hopefully when I do a part two, I will have you back in here so that we can talk about that alcoholism and drug culture, so that you can describe